Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, we discuss the Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy 2022 anthology with guest editor Rebecca Roenhorse, series editor John Joseph Adams, and best-selling author Veronica Roth. The following conversation originally took place November 13th, 2022 at the American Writers Museum and was recorded live.
On behalf of the American Writers Museum, I want to welcome everyone here to today's program. My name is Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director at the museum. Today's event celebrates the publication of 2022's Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy Writing Anthology. And with us to talk about the best speculative fiction of the year are guest editor Rebecca Roenhorse and series editor John Joseph Adams, joined by moderator and best-selling author Veronica Roth. Please join me in welcoming them to the AWM.
Put my giant coat down. Hello, welcome. I'm Veronica Roth, so I'm just going to give you the intro to these folks. All right. I'm a professional, I promise. Okay. John Joseph Adams is the series editor of Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy and is the editor of more than 30 anthologies, such as Wastelands and The Living Dead. He is also editor and publisher of the Hugo Award-winning magazine Lightspeed. And for 5 years, he was the editor of the John Joseph Adams Books novel imprint for Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Lately, he's been working as an editor on TTRPG, is that how that would be said?
Sure.
Okay, projects for Kobold Press and Monte Cook Games, and as a contributing game editor, designer on books such as Tome of Heroes.
All right. Fancy, folks.
Yeah, you're very fancy. Rebecca Roenhorse is a New York Times bestselling and Nebula, Hugo, and Locus award-winning speculative fiction writer, no big deal, and the recipient of the 2018 Astounding Campbell Award for Best New Writer. Rebecca has published multiple award-winning short stories and 5 novels, including 2 in the Sixth World series, Star Wars Resistance Reborn, Race to the Sun for the Rick Riordan imprint, and her latest novel, the epic fantasy Black Sun. She has also written for Marvel Comics and for television and had projects optioned by Amazon Studios, Netflix, and Paramount TV. So I feel very lucky to be up here right now. Okay. So basically, you guys haven't read this collection of stories yet. So we're going to talk about short fiction generally, mostly, and then a little bit about the anthology specifically. But John, I wanted to start by asking you to give the rundown of what this anthology is, how it's put together,
sure.
All that.
So Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy is part of the Best American series, which goes back like more than 100 years, started with Best American Short Stories. Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy started, this is volume 8, so about 8 years ago. The goal is to collect, as the name suggests, the best science fiction fantasy writing published during the year. But because it's part of the Best American series, we have this American requirement, which kind of is fitting that we're in this American Writers Museum talking about it because, they had to identify what is American, and so did we. And so where it stands now is that we've pushed it to, or I pushed it to, for this volume anyway, to North America. So it's like, okay, anything in North America, because otherwise it was like America and Canada. I'm like, well, why just America and Canada? There's other countries in North America. Canada is not America. So if America means North America, let's include all of North America. And so that's where it stands now. And then it's like, well, if you live here, that also counts. So like if you're British, but you live here, that counts. I'm just trying to make it as broadly inclusive as possible. With it having still some notion that American means something to writing, I'm not sure if it's a useful term at this point in the world where it's like so easy to get fiction from every corner of the globe, I guess globes don't have corners, but people say that. And then otherwise it's just, as series editor, I try to read every story that's published in the genres over the course of the year that's eligible, meaning that's written by somebody who is American or it's a publisher that is American by these terms that, we've laid out. I winnow it down to a list of top 80 stories. And so, because the anthology does science fiction and fantasy, I do 40 science fiction, 40 fantasy. And then, I get the manuscripts all together, and I strip the names off of them, and I strip the name of the publications off of them. So the guest editor, like Rebecca, and Veronica was the previous guest editor. So when I give them the stories, they just have the stories, the titles. They don't know who wrote it. They don't know where it was published. They just know that I thought it was good. and then they read those 80 stories, and then it's their job to pick the best 10 of both science fiction and fantasy. And then that's what goes in the book. And it's like the process of deciding that is like, it can be, extremely difficult, which I'm sure these two can talk more about. It's definitely hard to pick the top 80, but, at least, you know, I always have this fear that I'm going to have missed something, you know, and it's like, oh, and then like when award nominations come out and it's like, oh, I didn't even know about that thing. And, you know, and as much as I try, but, anyway.
Yeah. I remember you sent me one late last year.
Yeah.
It was like,
yeah.
Oh, this one was notable. Read it.
Yeah.
Okay. I will. And Rebecca, why were you on board for doing this? What interested you?
Well, so actually, I remember the year that I won the Hugo for best short story. My short story was one of those that did not mm-hmm. get noticed until after it won. And I kind of gave John a hard time on Twitter. I was like, hey, what about this one? It just won the Hugo mm-hmm. and the Nebula, and you didn't even see it. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, mea culpa, can't do everything. And now I absolutely understand much better how difficult the job is. Before I was a little snarky. So I think, you know, when John brought the idea to me, you know, not only are there notables like yourself and Diana Gabaldon, I'm going to pronounce that incorrectly, and N.K. Jemisin and other folks have been editors. So to be asked was honestly really an honor. And so you get to be a bit of a tastemaker, I guess, mm-hmm. at least for that year in science fiction and fantasy. And so that's, you know, why I took the gig on. Mm-hmm. Plus, I love to read short fiction. Mm-hmm. So
did you find it to be difficult to pick your top?
More so, yes. More so in fantasy than science fiction. I know my taste in science fiction pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And you know, you sort of get a rhythm. Like after you've read a page, you're like, oh, I can tell, am I going to like this? Is this my style? Not my style. Not so much the value of the story, because clearly everything you give us is already good. But is this the kind of story that I enjoy, that I want to see, you know, to say, hey, put my stamp on. I want other people to read this too. You can tell pretty quickly. I would always read the entire story because sometimes you start and it seems a bit slow or it seems not your style, but then two or three pages in and you're like, holy crap, this really took a turn. Like they've hit their stride and it's really good. So I would try to give everything a full read. And fantasy was very difficult. That's really my genre. Very difficult to sort of narrow down. If I could have put like another three or four in, I absolutely would have. But science fiction, I was like, we're not doing that.
I think I had the exact opposite. But that's interesting because I write mostly sci-fi and you write mostly fantasy, so it makes sense. All right, so I thought we'd talk about short fiction generally. You mentioned that you like to read it. Obviously, John, you like to read it. I know that.
Yeah, it's okay.
But my question, sure. My question is, what was my first question? Sorry. Basically, why do you like short fiction?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's like I came to it fairly late in my reading sort of career or whatever, just as a reader. You know, when I was growing up, I mean, all I ever saw was novels in the you know, small bookstore that I had access to. And it was before like Amazon had become a thing and you could just get any book. I did work at a bookstore, so I knew you could order books and get them delivered to the bookstore and everything, but I didn't know about all the different stuff out there. The closest I came to was like Ben Bova had books in that store and he had some collections. And in his collections, he talked he had a little intro before each story and he would like talk about this like whole world out there that I had no idea about. Like, where are these magazines that he was publishing in? Like Analog, he edited that and won a bunch of awards for it. What's that? Like, we didn't have Analog in that store, you know? So like, that was sort of my introduction to short fiction. And I just kind of got hooked on it by reading those stories. And then, I'm kind of an obsessive person. It's kind of my defining character trait, as my friend John said once. I just dove into it head first and I was like, okay, well, I got to figure out what all this stuff is, you know? And, I started doing all that research. And then, before I became an editor, like, you know, I I was playing a lot of Dungeons and Dragons and stuff, and it's like, that's a very creative endeavor. And so I was sort of urged to make, I had this urge to create something myself, you know, and so I didn't enjoy doing, creating stuff for D&D at the time. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll try writing something. And so I, you know, it was an interest in writing and reading that got me to short stories, because when you're initially writing, it's like, oh, well, short stories is a thing. That's a, that seems like a much more attainable goal than writing a novel. Easier said than done, but, certainly not true for everyone, but,
Yeah, judging by my face, a nightmare.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, that's how I got to short stories. But I mean, I love that you can communicate so much in such a short span of words. You can have this emotional heft. You can have levity. You can put all of this stuff into a short story that feels like you've read a novel, even if you've only read something that's 5,000 words or less. And I always keep hoping that, like, with the short attention spans of the world these days, that people will sort of take up short stories as like, oh, that's something I can read in one sitting and I'll be done. But it hasn't really taken off as much. Still so many people just don't even know what a short story is, or that they exist, or that there are magazines that publish them. They're like, best of the year, where do these things come from? You know, much like I did back in the day. But
yeah, well, Rebecca, what do you like about short fiction? Both writing it and reading it, I would say. Very different.
Yeah, so I never thought I would write short fiction. I first wrote a novel, sold the novel, and then there was a call for short fiction for Indigenous fantasists. And I was like, well, maybe I'll try to write a short story. Maybe that'll help me, like, you know, get my name out there and, you know, before the novel comes out. And then the short story did incredibly well. I thought maybe like 100 people would read it max, maybe more like 20 people would read it. And then that's the one that won all the awards and stuff. So that was kind of awesome. And then I realized I really enjoyed writing short fiction. I feel like you can sort of get in, give that emotional punch and get out. And it feels really good. And you can do a lot of world building. Like you said, you can do it, make a 7,000 words, do a lot of work. It is challenging. I just wrote a novella that's coming out on Tuesday. That's about 200 pages. Yeah, that sucked. I would not, the novellas are really hard. So, you know, novels, that's great. I can write, you know, 80,000 words, 130,000 words, because that really lets you expand and you can sort of breathe and, you know, really take your time creating these worlds. Short fiction, you go in, boom, you know, give an emotional punch, you know, make a single point that you're trying to make and tell that story. Novellas, somewhere in between is this awful, murky place.
I liked it.
Yeah, how do you? See, so everyone's different, you know, everyone sort of like something works for them and something doesn't. Please buy my book Tuesday, but I'm not saying it's not good.
No, just because it's challenging doesn't mean it doesn't turn out well.
Yeah.
I do have an editor.
Because it was hard, that's why it turned out to be good, I'm sure.
Yeah,
you know,
let's
because
go
you,
with that.
You sweated it so much, you know.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes that's true.
I know, yeah.
Do you guys think that there's something about science fiction and fantasy that like lends itself towards short fiction? Because I feel like it's very strong in short fiction in sci-fi and fantasy.
Yeah.
But I have trouble figuring out why.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's certainly been a strong tradition of it, and I think that's part of what has kept it so alive in the community, because it's like, I mean, although it's true, like in sort of like mainstream or literary fiction as well, there's so many different publications that do publish that stuff. Although, like, aside from like the New Yorker or the Atlantic or whatever, it's like, you know, you have to really be looking to find those things a lot of the time. At least whereas like with science fiction and fantasy, back in the day, like these things were on newsstands very easily accessible, like, and they had good circulations and stuff back then. Not as true today, but now with the internet, it's like, you know, there's online magazines all over the place. And so it's a lot more easy to get those stories out there. And I mean, I think for short stories, as far as science fiction and fantasy goes, though, the other thing is that because so many science fiction sort of ideas are like about this idea, when you can just communicate that idea in the short story, and you don't really need to, you know, expand it out into a whole novel. Like, for instance, like a lot of people love the novel Flowers for Algernon. Flowers for Algernon, the story is one of my favorite stories of all time. But it's like, and it's like the novel's good too, but like it didn't need to be a novel. The novelette is perfect. It's like everything else that went into the novel was just expanding it to novel length for commercial reasons or something. I mean, I'm being very, snotty about it, but
hot take.
Yeah. Hot take. Yeah. When you can just communicate the idea, explore it as fully as it needs to, and then just stop, like, or, you know, conclude it. Don't just stop. It's bad when you just stop. Conclude it. You know, it's really satisfying, you know? And I think science fiction and fantasy is like a genre that really excels at doing that. Because a lot of other genres, it's like, I mean, I guess I'm kind of surprised it's not more prevalent in mystery, because you could certainly do a quick mystery and, you know, solve it by the end of a short story. But, and it's like, there is some tradition of it, but not huge.
Thoughts? Did I have a question?
No, I'm trying to remember why my original question was.
Oh, if science fiction and fantasy lends itself
to short stories. Yeah.
If you'd like to talk about that, you can, but I have another question for you.
Oh, let's do another one.
Okay. When you start writing an idea, how do you know that it's a short story or a novella or a novel?
I know before I start.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't play fast and loose with that. I have an idea. I tend to outline generally. I don't always follow my outline. I leave a little space for the muse to take me where it wants to go. But when I am structuring my story, I do a story structure before I start writing. And so I know if it's going to be short or it's going to be long. And then I conform my ideas and my writing to the length. Yeah.
So you get an idea and you think, like, this is obviously a short story idea. Have you ever been confused?
You know, I'm writing a short story right now, actually, for John, and it could be a novel. Like, I feel to myself, oh, you know what? This could be a novel.
But could be both, just saying.
Yeah,
that's true.
I'm not going to let it do that. I'm going to, you know, keep it reined in. I'm going to explore this one idea. We're going to go in, get out, like that sort of thing. So, you know, I guess no. I tend to be a little more of a controlled writer.
Yeah, I kind of feel like if I'm writing a short story, it's like, this can only be a short story because if I went further, it would fall apart and you would start to see what's wrong with it.
That's possible, too.
So just trying to be sneaky here. And John, is there anything in particular you look for when you're evaluating short stories? Like, is there anything that's like a immediate hard pass? In case we have writers out here.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like to talk about like what the hard pass would be, just because.
Okay.
Well, no. It's because like I don't want a writer to not write a thing because I said something on an interview or in a panel, and I don't want them to not send me a story because like if we're open to submissions and they're like, oh well, I wrote this zombie story, but on this panel John said he's sick of zombie stories. I'm not going to send it there. But like, you know, even if I am sick of zombie stories, I might still love the best zombie story ever. You know, I almost certainly would. You know, and so. You know, like that's why I don't like to talk about the hard pass, but in terms of like what I actually would, you know, be looking for, I mean, I think the thing that jumps out at me first often is like the voice, because like that can be kind of the hardest thing to rein in and develop. And then otherwise, you know, usually get grabbed by character and then like plot things. And it's like if it's doing something that I've never seen before, like in terms of I mean, with plot, it's like very rare that you haven't seen anything like it. But I mean, if a writer's doing something very like taking a unique approach with it, it sort of jumps out. But yeah, I think voice is what sort of is the first thing that I usually notice. Voice can patch up a lot of cracks in narrative, you know, probably better than anything else.
Mm. So I read your guys' introductions to this anthology, and Rebecca, you said at one point, which I really liked, yes, as an author of speculative fiction, I often wrangle with big questions, but my writing is more often obsessed with the smaller questions. So I'm wondering, what are some of the smaller and bigger questions that were explored in these stories, just like on a big?
Yeah. So and I say this, I think, in the introduction, that big question came up at a Worldcon a while back on this science fiction fantasy panel. And I can't even remember what the original question was, but everybody's going on about, you know, sort of these big ideas that science fiction is supposed to explore, you know, I don't know. It's usually like conquest, or, you know, so colonization, whatever, people on Mars, that sort of thing. And, you know, when it came to me, I was like, I like the smaller questions. I want to know about relationship. I want to know about community. How do we survive? How do we understand each other on an interpersonal level? Like, these are the things that fascinate me and interest me. And when fiction is good, I feel like it's grappling with those questions. Sure, we can talk about these bigger questions too, but where is the emotion? Where is like the gut punch in the story that I'm always looking for, both to write and to read? It's in these small interpersonal details. And those are the things I think that make or break a story. And so in these In the stories that I chose, I think that really shows. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stories in this collection are about interpersonal relationships. I think a lot of it coming out of COVID. I think all of these were written or at least published during the years of COVID and isolation and quarantine. And so a lot of these stories are grappling with how do we know each other? How do we create community? How do we find love or humanity, and how do we define all of that to ourselves and to each other? And so those are sort of the things that I was drawn to. And people have all different kinds of ideas about what that looks like. There was one story I was just thinking of, The Cold Calculations, which deals with, you know, how to, I'm not gonna try to spoil any stories in case like people wanna go read them and be surprised. But it's the sort of frame story around it is, There's an astronaut and a girl as a stowaway on his ship, and they don't have enough fuel to make landing to give these vaccines to a planet that needs them because her weight has thrown off the fuel differential or whatever. I just threw that science-y word in. and so he has to make the hard decision about who lives, who dies. Because he could shoot the girl out the airlock, but then she's dead. Or he could save her, but then the people who need the vaccines don't get the vaccines. And who was the a-hole back at, you know, the home office who decided he can't have any extra fuel because we have to save a few pennies, and now he can't save the girl.
It's like the trolley problem, but like in sci-fi space. Story form.
Yeah. But it's great, you know, and there's all these little mini stories within that story about people making these same sort of decisions about who lives, who dies, what the calculation is, what is human life worth? That's a big question. I think that takes on the big question, but it's also really about these individuals who are grappling with the decisions immediately in their lives and how they make those decisions.
I think like in the last year's anthology, like half the stories were about grief. And there was kind of that trend in this too, that a bunch of them were about grief. Yeah. I just wonder if there's something specific about COVID that we think about the loneliness and isolation of COVID, but we don't think about the grief of it that often. Not just for the people who have died, but for, you know, the lifestyle that we've had to let go of and all that stuff.
Yeah, and I'll just throw out, you're right, there are stories, quite a few stories about grief. I think Proof of Induction, which is about a son grappling with his father's death and how they sort of meet in the afterlife-ish, in an AI simulation, and what that means. Like, what would you do if you got to talk to the person that, you know, you lost? And it wasn't that great a relationship to begin with. If you could do it again, what would you do? There's also I Was a Teenage Space Jockey by Stephen Graham Jones, which is out about a young boy grappling with the loss of his older sibling, locked into an arcade game where maybe he can achieve some sort of connection. Gosh, I'm sure there's other ones too, but those are the two that really like pop out of me that were like wonderful stories of like grief.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something about The Cold Calculations. A lot of stories have been written over the years that are a response to The Cold Equations, which is a classic story by Tom Godwin. And this story, I think, is one of the best ones that I've, I mean, maybe the best one that I've read. A lot of people keep grappling with the same question that Tom Godwin was grappling with and, calling BS on his solution in the story. And so that's clearly what drove the author to write this one. But, I thought it was a really interesting way to explore it, you know, like as you were describing. And so, if anyone's familiar with The Cold Equations, it's like, I think definitely this one's worth a read.
John, when you were reading like all the submissions, did you notice any trends?
Not really. I mean, I don't really specifically go out to look for those, you know. I almost kind of go out of my way to not find them just because like I want each story to stand by itself and not allow my opinion of a story to be influenced by any other story that's out that year. And so not really.
You weren't, you know, like, lots of these are about futuristic soldiers, because we last year there were like five. It's like, right. Okay.
I probably didn't even notice. But you know, like sometimes like I'll pick up on trends and stuff. And so like, I mean, when I did my first anthology, Wastelands, it was like, it was like, because in the years after 9/11, it's like okay, well, there was this huge increase in people writing post-apocalyptic fiction again, whereas it had been kind of out of style. That was like the first time I noticed one. But in terms of Best American, I don't know. Just because it's so important to identify like the best stories without it being influenced by the other ones that are adjacent to it, I try to go out of my way to not take too much from it.
This might be like too insidery, but how did you guys figure out what order to put them?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, we had like that conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Gosh, you know, I knew. So I guess for me, and I think John, we sort of worked together, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You threw out some ideas. I can't remember.
I gave you like a framework of how it usually works. Yeah.
Yeah. So I picked some of the sort of shorter, lighter stories for the beginning. Like, I think the mm-hmm. first one is like A Whole New You in 10 Days, mm-hmm. which is told in a really strong voice mm-hmm. About a woman that basically becomes like a blood-sucking like folklore creature. But, so you know, it's sort of like step one, do this, step two, do that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's fun, that's snappy, that sort of gets you in. And then the last story in the collection, just... oh, it's a tearjerker. Like, I wept. That was, you know, mm-hmm. it broke my heart. It's so good. But I thought, nobody wants to read this, like, at the beginning. You know, this is one you get through. This is the last mm-hmm. story. You want it to sit, you know, you want to sit with it. You want to, like, process it. It's difficult, but it's really, really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So you're thinking of it as, like, a continuous reading experience.
Yeah, which I know it's not.
Well, I mean, who knows? It might be.
Yeah, but, yeah. But people tend to flip around. Yeah. But hopefully you understand, like, maybe the mm-hmm. ones near the end are going to be a little heavier mm-hmm. than the ones mm-hmm. near the beginning. Yeah,
I feel like as an editor, you always have to put the table of contents together for that ideal reader who will just read it in the way that you presented it, mm-hmm. even if it's unlikely that people will. Because somebody will. Like, somebody will be like, oh, I should follow the rules. And it's arranged in this order for a reason, surely.
Like listening to an album. You have
yeah,
to.
Yeah, yeah,
there you go.
Don't hit shuffle. What are you doing? That's wrong.
Oh, man. Okay, so... sorry, I'm just thinking my music listening habits and how horrifying they must be. Okay, so what if someone is kind of new to reading genre fiction, what story do you think that they should start with now that we've talked about how you should read it beginning to end?
No pressure. Oh, I think it depends on what you like.
Yeah.
So if you like traditional fantasy, I did throw in... Elizabeth Baer's story. Mm-hmm.
That's a great story.
Do you remember the title?
The Red Mother.
The Red Mother, which is sort of this, it's like a whole epic fantasy mm-hmm. in like 10,000 words or something.
Yeah.
About, it's a traditional sort of wizard on a quest that has to like confront a dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so well done, but it's very sort of, you know, fantasy. We're not doing... If the Martians Had Magic, for example, mm-hmm. that's also in there by P. Jelly Clark, who's mm-hmm. one of my favorite writers. And so maybe start there if you like traditional fantasy, if you want something that's a little more humane. Oh, gosh, I don't know. Well, maybe If the Martians Have Magic. I don't know. Something like that. I mean, I think there's things for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I tried to pick a variety of different kinds of stories so that someone could find at least something that they liked, no mm-hmm. matter what their style was.
Mm-hmm. I would just quibble with your description of the Red Mother. I believe he was a bard, not a wizard.
Oh, my bad.
So,
do you agree with that assessment of?
Yeah. That'll make sense to me. And it is so hard to pick like a particular thing. I mean, that's part of what makes ordering an anthology hard in the first place, because mm-hmm. it's like, well, you kind of have to try to do a default, pick a default first story for people to read. When we put these things together, like, it's not actually explicit, like, in the table of contents, because, I don't know, the people who work in-house said you're not allowed to do this. But it's like, I always wanted to just identify, okay, this story is science fiction, this story is fantasy, this story is science fiction. And so in the table of contents, it's like one, you know, one story after another. So, but we always do... We always alternate them. So like, this one starts with a fantasy story, and then so the next one's science fiction. And so like, I would rather it be so that I could just put it in the table of contents that it says what it is. So that way, if you are a reader who prefers one or the other, you could, well, I'll start with story number two because I like science fiction more. Of course, most of the Amazon reviews and stuff say like, why is this all science fiction? Why is this all fantasy? Of the same volume, mind you.
That's very funny.
Yeah, it's just like nobody is like, well, because it's like people have this idea of like what fantasy is. They think like, oh, well, fantasy has dragons in it. Fantasy is like Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones or whatever. And then when they see something like 10 Stories to a Whole New You or 10 Ways to a Whole New You, it's like, they don't know what to make of that. They're like, well, what is this? There's no dragons in this. There's like some kind of magic or whatever, but like, I just don't understand it. And then like on the science fiction side, it's like, well, science fiction has spaceships. It has aliens. Like, What is this? This is technology and weird things are happening. It's set on Earth. I don't understand. You know, and so I think they don't.
Yeah, people get very fussy about the definitions for sure.
But it's like, you know, like I'm all about, like, I mean, I think short fiction in particular is all about like, make this thing broad. You know, like anything that falls within the broad scope of like what is science fiction, what is fantasy, like that's where people excel with short fiction. When you go to do it at novel length, it's much more risky, you know, because if you get people who have these kinds of reactions, it's like, well, they're not going to pick up that book. It doesn't have a dragon in it. It doesn't have a dragon on the cover. You know, so like Robert Jordan cheated and used things like, oh, the Dragon Reborn. It's like, there's no dragons in this. Come on. That's just a guy calling himself a dragon.
It's funny you should mention dragons because it does lead into my next question.
All right.
Is when I did it, so I don't like dragons. Sorry. I don't. But a bunch of the stories that were in my top 25 were about dragons because I was like, well, I guess I've been sold on dragons, especially Kate Elliott's. I don't remember the name of that one was, but it's so awesome.
Of the Earth or something? Was that it?
No.
That's a different one. Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, it was great. So I was wondering if there was anything that you don't usually like that you found yourself liking. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh gosh, well I'm sure there's something in the science fiction. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm trying to think. I wish I had a list of all the stories.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
And then I'd be like, oh yeah, look there.
I should have warned you guys. I was going to get this specific.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Gosh. Oh, you know. No, that's fantasy actually. But I will say, The Captain and the Quartermaster.
Oh yeah.
By C.L. Clarke. Sort of this. War story of a captain and a quartermaster who I believe like are married. It's about like how to survive sort of a war and then how to survive the end of a relationship. And I thought, I don't know if this is really my style. Mm-hmm. But you know, I was convinced. Like by the time I read it, I was like, you know what, this is really interesting. Like what they're doing in this sort of short expanse of words. I'm always impressed by how much story an author can get across in very little words. Mm-hmm. So if I come away from that and I feel like I have lived in your world, that this place is real in my mind and these people feel like real people, then I consider that successful. And of course, like, I'm like, oh, I'm so blind. some of these are really good. I'm like, some of these are really good. You guys should read these.
You should really read it.
Oh, so I'll just throw out though the if you're like a horror reader or like you really love Shirley Jackson, like Kelly Link's story in this book is so good. It's called Skindler's Veil. And I won't tell you anything about it because that's how you should go into it. But
Kelly Link in general.
Good. Well, yeah. I mean, she's legitimately a genius. The MacArthur Foundation says so. you know, she got the genius grant. So, you know, but yeah, that story is just so amazing. And just couldn't possibly predict like where it goes, even knowing that it's like a Shirley Jackson story, basically. Well, it was originally published in an anthology that was a tribute anthology to Shirley Jackson. So they were all supposed to be written like as if they were, you know, Shirley Jackson stories.
Are there any that you're still thinking about that are in here?
I mean, well, yeah, that one for sure. I mean, also like The Future Library by Peng Shepard.
Oh yeah.
That's a absolutely fantastic story. And like, yeah, like no idea where that was going. And that was an interesting one where it's like, it has so many elements of science fiction, but then it also has these elements of fantasy. And it's like, it's one of those things where it's like frustrating to have to just decide which one is it, like when we're labeling it. I stupidly have done this my whole career. Like at Lightspeed, we have slots for science fiction and fantasy. And like sometimes there are stories where it's like, well, but it's both. And which one takes precedence? You know, I had a story recently that was so long that we published it in two parts. And it was one of these that was science fiction and fantasy. And so it's like I ran the first part and called it science fiction. And I ran the second part and called it fantasy.
Was that S.G.'s Dempsey?
It was. Yeah.
Oh, God, I love that story.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, and it's like, and then when Best American came along, I stupidly did the same thing where it's like, oh no, we have, well, cause I wanted it to be equal. I wanted there to be, you know, I wanted a science fiction fan to have as much, access to it as a fantasy fan would. Even though like I kind of suspected a lot of people would basically say, oh, it's all fantasy, whatever. Yeah. You know, so
can't please everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any revelations? Yeah. What are you still thinking about? Are there any that you're still thinking about?
Oh, God, I could talk about a lot of these.
Sorry.
Okay. You know what? As I'm scrolling through this, I thought of L'Esprit, L'Escalier mm-hmm. by Catherine Invalente, which is a retelling of Orpheus and Eurydice as like suburban hipsters. And it is dark, though. It mm-hmm. is weird and dark and just awesome. And that one really was like, ooh, look at that. I tend not to like retellings. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big fairy tale. I'm not a big fairy tale mm-hmm. person. I'm not a big fan of that. But her taking this like myth and retelling it as like they're suburban hipsters and like their relationship is just souring, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, it's so good. It's really, really cool. And she's great anyway. Like her stuff is always kind of freaky. So yeah, great
one. Well, right on time, I think.
Oh.
We're ready to do a Q&A if you guys have cues that we need to A.
We're just gonna ask folks to come back here to the Q&A mic so that the people following along online can hear us. And I wanted to start you off with a question from EM on Zoom, mm-hmm. who wants to ask each of you, what is your personal golden rule of writing?
Mm. Who wants to go first?
What does that mean? Golden rule of writing.
Oh, do unto others as they do unto you in your writing? I don't know. I think it just means what's your number one rule, probably.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Say that again. What did you say, Tom?
I think they just mean what would be your number one rule in writing?
Oh. That there are no rules. No.
Yeah.
Gosh, I don't know. I don't know. Make me feel something. I think mm-hmm, I mentioned that mm-hmm. before as a reader and as a writer. You mm-hmm. know, they always say like no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. So, you know, I'm reading for emotion. I'll be honest. Like plot. No, that's great. You know, but character, emotion, I want to feel something. So I have to make you feel something when I write. And you as the writer, hopefully will make me feel something too.
I agree with that. Mm-hmm. I would also say only take with you what you need to get to the end.
Mm-hmm.
How I try to approach things.
It's also good adventuring advice.
Yes, that's how it was put to me by my professor. It was like, imagine you're packing a backpack and you're trying to climb to the top of a mountain. Like, you don't want to put your hair dryer in there. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And I mean, for me, I don't know. I mean, I think... show me something that I haven't seen before, I guess. But I mean, that's a lot easier said than done. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think in order to achieve that, you just have to read widely and get inspiration from all different kinds of sources. And so I guess that would be my number one rule, is to read widely and read outside the genres that you actually love and or want to write in, and pull those inspirations from all those different places. Because a lot of times people writing your genre aren't looking in that direction. And so like you can come up with something that's like nobody else is doing because nobody's looking over there. And
So I guess what I was thinking, hearing you all, and enjoyed it, was what differentiates science fiction from fiction?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a science.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was thinking, well, how do you use that criteria when you evaluate mm-hmm. stories, science fiction stories, not fantasy?
Mm-hmm.
Do you look at, is the science accurate?
Mm-hmm.
Is the science egregiously wrong? does that, you know, color your judgment downward
mm-hmm.
when the science is mistaken?
Right.
Or is the science so out there, yet the science mm-hmm. is based on some actual science? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've read some science fiction where you just go back to your science books. And, wait a minute, let's look at relativity.
Yeah.
So that's the question.
Right. I think like I'm not a scientist and I don't have like a incredible depth of knowledge of physics and such. I have read a lot of science fiction. I approach each story and it's like, well, do I believe what the author is selling me? You know? Mm-hmm. And, sometimes the answer is no. And I'm like, you know, like I just don't buy what's going on with this scientifically. And maybe sometimes I can like look up something to see if I'm wrong, but most of the time it's just like, well, the author has to present it in a way that I'm going to believe it regardless of whether or not it's accurate science. I feel like I have a good sense of like when something's just BS or whatever, or it's like, oh, I don't know, this doesn't pass the sniff test or whatever, you know, like, nobody's going to buy this. It's like, it's too, or, but the thing is, it's like, it usually matters more what's important to the narrative. And so it's like, does this work hand in hand with what the narrative is telling us? And is this even important? Maybe we should just have it in the background. Like, we don't have to explain why there's gravity on this ship that's flying from point A to point B in the solar system or the galaxy or whatever. It's like, we can just, okay, yeah, they figured that out at some point, you know? And, it's like when you stop to put all those details in there that it gets very messy, where it's like, okay, well, if you're going to put all this scientific stuff in there, okay, now it has to make sense. If you're glossing over it, as long as it generally seems like it makes sense with what we understand of as science fiction, from media and books and all manner of things, then I think that's sufficient.
Mm-hmm. I think also you can get people to believe, like, what's that rule? That's like one impossible thing.
Oh, uh-huh.
So it's like just trying to limit the amount of like ridiculous things that you're proposing is helpful, but there is a, like, people have different tolerances for this, for mm-hmm. sure. Like, some people really love very hard sci-fi, which is like very grounded in mm-hmm. in fact and science, and some people are much more tolerant of explosions in space and interstellar travel, which is, as we know it, impossible or whatever. Like, you know, so the extent to which you're frustrated by this is sort of subject to your individual.
The ring world is unstable.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, and like, I tend to like Star Wars, so, you know, mm-hmm. what's science there?
But that's like it's like fantasy science. It's like,
yeah,
you know,
like,
which
space
one is
wizards,
it?
Wizards, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, that's my space tolerance wizard, level, yeah. So, yeah, I think it varies.
But I guess that raises another question, which is like, well, you're determining the line between these two. So what is the line?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think fantasy is about something that's impossible, but is possible in the story. And science fiction is about something that's theoretically possible, but isn't. And so, like, I think that's the main criteria when you boil it down. You know, you could obviously quibble about that a little bit more, but that's like
and
the base.
And will later.
Yeah. But that's the base, like, where it's like fantasy is about something that's impossible. And I think that's what a large percentage of the wider reading audience doesn't understand when they think that, like, well, it has to be in this secondary world. It has to have dragons. It has to have magic. And it's like, well, but no, like, if you have a story about a room full of people at a museum and one of them can sense what this other person's thinking, it's like, well, that's fantasy because that's an impossible thing that's happening in the story. And, you know, so. I guess it could be science fiction too, depending if you believe in like psionics and all that kind of stuff.
Do you have your own definition for what makes a fantasy and not sci-fi? Or
no, I tend to mix genres. Mm-hmm. I tend to like throw it all together, write science, fantasy, mm-hmm. and like, I don't know, whatever, you know, like you said, whatever is integral to the story mm-hmm. and you can sell to the reader, that works for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Hi. I once saw this interview with Stephen King and George Martin, mm-hmm. and they were talking about their daily process. Mm-hmm. And Stephen King was like, 4 hours a day, if it's good or bad, mm-hmm. I'm writing. And George R. Martin was like, you know, when the muse hits me, I'll stay up for a week straight and write, and then I'll take a year off.
Where's the muse at?
Yeah. I was wondering if you guys could share your kind of daily grind habits.
Yeah. So it depends. When I'm on deadline, which, you know, thankfully is most of the time, I tend to write consistently, like take my daughter to school, maybe find a coffee shop usually, and I'll write for about 4 hours. Take a break, then I'll edit in the afternoon. And depending on like sort of where I am mentally, I might write again that night. I tend to do my best writing like from 11 p.m. to like 2 to 3 a.m. because it's quiet. No one's emailing you. Mm-hmm. My husband and my daughter don't need anything. They're asleep, hopefully. So, and for some reason, my mind, you know, they say if you're a little tired, your mind tends to be a little more receptive to weird ideas and things. So often I'll write during those hours, but I am consistent. I try to like keep to a schedule because I love George, but when he takes those breaks for a couple of years, it's a little frustrating, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Yeah. And if you take that long a break, I'm just like, how do you even get back into it?
Yeah.
Like your mind's no longer primed to think of this thing. So God bless him, but I don't know how that works. Yeah. For me, I'm
similar to you, yeah. I can't set time goals or word count goals because then I will just tread water until I reach that goal instead of actually making progress. So I usually set like a scene goal or a, you know, other kind of marker goal. But then if I'm doing like publicity, like, you know, if I'm traveling for a book, I can't write at the same time. So like right now I just went on book tour and now my brain is completely scrambled, so I can't work, but I'll start up again. So it is a little bit seasonal for me too.
For me, it's just, you know, ABR, always be reading, you know, you know, I just gotta be reading all the time, you know. I just try to squeeze the reading in wherever I can, you know. I mean, any minute that I'm just like, you know, standing in line reading or something, you know, or like I use a text to speech program sometimes to turn things into audio so that I can listen like I'm walking the dogs or doing chores and things. And it's a tricky process. You kind of have to teach it a lot because it's like it doesn't know how to say a lot of things and stuff. But it's pretty sophisticated at this point. So. I wouldn't like say it's going to replace like audiobooks or anything, but it's fine for determining, is this story entertaining? And, you know, so.
Is this anthology on audiobook?
It is. Yes. It is available now. Has a cast of, I don't know, I think 5 or 6 different readers, and some of them read several stories. But they did a really good job of matching the narrator to the story. And like some of the stories were like, required a very specific narrator because it's like it would have been offensive basically if somebody else read it, like to read it in the vernacular of the story. It's really well done. I listened to like I think like 80% of it or something, as I was just sort of rereading to catch up on, you know. It's like by the time we do one of these events, I've already read like a billion other words for this year, you know, and so it's like I barely even remember these stories, you know. The refresher was nice.
Do you get writer's block? And if so, what do you do?
Yeah. What do you do, Rebecca?
So if you had asked me this like 6 months ago, I would have been like, oh, I never get writer's block. I like juggle different projects. And when I'm stuck on this project, I just shift gears and I work on this project. It's all good. But for the past 6 months, I've had writer's block. So in different ways, just because there's a lot of my life going on behind the scenes that is not conducive to being creative. I cry a lot. I suffer. I read. Honestly, if I get stuck, usually that means that I need to go refill the well, as they say. So I need to go see what other people are doing. I need to read. I need to watch TV shows or films. I need to go look at art. I need to go sort of absorb as much creativity and story and other people's imagination as possible. And hopefully I will find inspiration again. And then sometimes you just need to rest. Like resting is part of the process too. You can't be on, your brain cannot be on all the time. Sometimes it needs to just stare at the wall or imagine stuff that has nothing to do with deadlines and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, one time I had a breakthrough because I told myself, okay, you're not allowed to work for 2 weeks. And it was like, aha. It's like something relaxed and I was able to think. I refill the well, take a break. Like relentless productivity is not good for anyone, no matter what people tell you. And I also think a lot of times when I get writer's block, it's because whatever I just did was like wrong for the story. And I have to just like admit it to myself and go back. Sometimes this involves deleting like 100 pages. It's terrible. But it does happen. And then at that point, it usually like kind of unleashes or unlocks the whatever, you know, some metaphor. I'm a writer.
I don't get writer's block.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, I do when I have to write the introduction or the forward to Best American, because like, do I do this again? I have to make it different somehow from the last time. I finally figured out a template for it. So now it doesn't stress me out as much. Yeah.
Great. Well, I think we're ready to conclude, but thanks so much, everyone.
We are. I'd like to thank our panelists for being here. Veronica Roth, Rebecca Roanhorst, John Joseph Adams. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, celebrate the 100th anniversary of T.S. Eliot's iconic poem, The Wasteland, with scholar and professor Jed Rasula, author of What the Thunder Said, How the Wasteland Made Poetry Modern. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.